Thank you. Rabbinic literature is an invaluable resource for reconstructing the texts, the law codes, and the world of the Dead Sea Scrolls. However, as with all comparative projects, we must take methodological care not to read rabbinic literature back into the scrolls, nor the scrolls into rabbinic texts. And I think Professor Fahd's paper this morning was a great example of that. I'd like to re-emphasize that methodological care with another example. In their 2009 article, Vered Noam and Elisha Kimron presented a new reconstruction of a Sabbath legal text, 4Q 264A, that included a prohibition against playing a musical instrument on the Sabbath. They further claim that this fragment reveals ancient origins to the rabbinic law, similarly prohibiting producing music, as well as the prohibition against blowing shofar on Shabbat, because one may come to carry a bar amot. I would like to revisit these claims and show that their reconstruction is highly conjectural and that they have made this methodological error of reading the Bavli back into the Qumran scrolls. I would also like to emphasize the need to first perform a thorough source critical analysis of rabbinic texts before attempting to draw parallels from them to Second Temple literature. At the same time, the analysis below will also show how the scrolls can be an invaluable tool in helping to accurately reconstruct the history of halacha. Before focusing on the specific issue of playing musical instruments, it will first be necessary to briefly review the history of the Sabbath prohibitions from the Bible down through Second Temple, Tannaitic, and Amoraic sources. We will then come back to 4Q 264a. In the Ten Commandments, the Torah issues a general prohibition: the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. You shall not do any work, melacha, on the penalty of death. However, the Torah does not systematically define the parameters of such work, other than providing a few examples, including gathering and preparing food, gathering fuel, burning a fire, doing agricultural work, and working a slave or an animal. The prophets further mention performing business transactions and carrying wares to the gates for selling. It is up to the communities and sages of later generations to define more precisely the parameters of Sabbath observance. Mishnah Chagigah 1:8 appropriately comments that the laws of Sabbath are like mountains hanging from a strand. Or perhaps maybe better with manuscript Parma, as desert plants that are hanging from a few roots. For the Second Temple times, Jubilees and Damascus document, sources number 1 and 2 on your handout, preserve lists of acts prohibited on the Sabbath. These sources include, without distinction or categorization, both prohibitions mentioned explicitly in the Bible, as well as many more acts that the various sects of Jews also considered prohibited. Note that anything bold in the translation on your handout is considered only a rabbinic prohibition in rabbinic literature, and anything in italics is completely permitted by the rabbis. This shows visually how much more lenient the rabbis were than the sectarians in general. Jubilees applies one punishment for all violations, quote, "The man who does any of these things on the Sabbath shall die." Damascus document also provides one punishment of exclusion from the community for all violations. Tannaitic sources provide a more systematic definition of the Sabbath prohibitions. Mishnah Shabbat 7:2, source number 3, lists 39 principal labors, including activities relating to agriculture and food preparation, clothing manufacturing, preparation of parchment and writing, building, kindling a fire, and carrying. This codification excludes from biblically sanctioned punishment a host of activities that were considered punishable in Second Temple sources. Tannaitic sources do, however, provide another category of prohibition. Most significant is Mishnah Betzah 5:2, source number 4. I'll read it. Anything for which one is liable as a restful act, shavut, as an optional act or as a commanded act on the Sabbath, one is also liable on a festival. These are the restful acts. One may not climb a tree, one may not ride an animal, one may not float on the water, one may not clap, one may not slap, one may not dance, and so on. The term shivut originally refers to acts that are biblically prohibited because they violate the commandment to rest on the Sabbath. Early Midrashim accordingly anchor these prohibitions in biblical verses. Source number 5 reads, "I know that work, melacha, includes acts for which one is liable, a sin offering, but concerning an act for which one is not liable to sin offering. How do I know that one may not climb a tree, ride an animal, float on water, clap, slap one's thigh, or dance? Scripture therefore teaches any work. Another midrash derives the same conclusion from the word complete rest, Shabbaton, or from the word all in Exodus 23:24. Significantly, several of the actions listed in Mishnah Shabbat 5:2 are also prohibited in the Second Temple sources mentioned above. The Tanaim thus continue the Second Temple view that these various actions are prohibited by biblical sanction. However, the Tannaitic Midrashim also clearly distinguish between those actions that are punishable and those that are not. The Tannaim consider the Shavuot prohibitions to be more lenient than do the Second Temple sects, who consider them punishable. We see already that the Tannaitic law is more systematic and generally more lenient than sectarian law. When we come to Amoraic sources, we find that the Yerushalmi introduces a concept of tolada, an act that is in some way associated with one of the avot, and is equally prohibited. Palestinian Amoraim went to great efforts to extrapolate all of the activities that should be categorized as tolada associated with each one of the avot. The Talmud Yerushalmi takes on an extensive project of organizing hundreds of prohibited activities within the framework of the 39 avot, and this way continues the project of systematization already begun in the Mishnah by comprehensively classifying various activities within the rubric of Mishnah Shabbat 7:2. Regarding the category of Shavuot laws listed in Mishnah Betzah 5:2, the Talmud Yerushalmi generally continues the Tannaitic view that the various Shavuot laws are biblically sanctioned but carry no punishment. However, there are already voices in Yerushalmi interpreting these laws towards further leniency. Apparently, enough people were neglecting these laws that Rabbi Yochanan needed to declare in source number 8, "Let not a Shavuot be light in your eyes, for behold, laying down the hands upon a sacrifice is only prohibited as an optional act, yet the patriarchs of the world were divided over it." The Talmud Bavli further continues the project of systematization seen above, but does so using a strategy significantly different from that of the Yerushalmi. The Bavli, with only a few minor and late exceptions, does not utilize the term or concept of tolada. While the Yerushalmi conceives of the avot as particular acts and proceeds to associate them with other similar acts, the Bavli thinks of each av as a conceptual category of activity. Rather than say X is a tolada of Y, the Bavli writes X is prohibited as a form, mishum Y. Instead of simply associating various activities with specific activities named as avot, the Bavli conceives of 39 classes of activity, of which the named av is only one example. Regarding the category of Shavuot laws, the Bavli's view departs even more radically from the Palestinian sources. Commenting on Mishnah Betzah 5:2, Bavli Betzah 36b explains, source number 9. One may not climb a tree. This is a safeguard lest one pluck fruit. One may not ride on an animal. This is a safeguard lest one travels past the Sabbath boundary. Can this derive that the Sabbath boundaries are biblical? Rather, this is a safeguard lest one come to cut a branch. One may not float on water. This is a safeguard lest one make a bottle for use as a flotation device. One may not clap. One may not slap one's thigh. One may not dance. This is a safeguard lest one come to repair musical instruments. There are two significant developments here. First, the Bavli considers all of the Shavuot laws to be only rabbinically mandated. Second, the Bavli considers each item listed in Mishnah Betzah 5:2 to be rabbinic preventative measure meant to keep one from inadvertently violating a more serious biblical prohibition. Why does the Bavli demote the status of Shavuot laws, and why does it apply to them the reason of a gezerah, which is not seemingly their original reason? Let us take each stage in turn. The Bavli's view of Shavuot laws as merely rabbinic is yet another aspect of its project of further systematization and conceptualization of Shabbat prohibitions. While most Tanaim consider the Shavuot laws to be biblical but not punishable, the Bavli may have found the existence of such a limbo state to be untidy and confusing. If the Shavuot laws are biblical, then they should be punishable. If they are not punishable, then they must be rabbinic. The systematic re-explanation by the Bavli Stam of the Shavuot laws as safeguards to prevent violation of biblical prohibitions must be understood within a larger context of similar activity. Abraham Goldberg cites a long list of prohibitions that later Babylonian rabbis considered to be safeguards, but are not explained as such in any earlier source. He writes that the motivation in these cases is to give a firm basis for these rabbinic laws by linking them to a biblical law and thereby bolstering their authority. Here too, once the Shivut laws were demoted to having only rabbinic backing, the rabbis decided to formulate them as safeguards for punishable biblical prohibitions. People would then take them more seriously, noting that even though the act in itself is rabbinic, it can easily lead to violating a biblical law and punishable. However, we know that it is always dangerous to give reasons for a law, because then if the reason for the law does not apply, people may permit it in such cases. The rabbis may have intended to buttress the Shavuot laws by means of defining them as safeguards, but this also runs the risk of limiting the laws to only cases to which the safeguard relates. This, in fact, occurs in at least some cases, and also may have been part of the motivation of the Bavli. Thus, by categorizing the Shavuot laws as rabbinic safeguards, the Bavli is able to have greater control over how to direct and define these prohibitions, both toward stringency and leniency. Let us focus on the example of making noise on the Sabbath. Mishnah Betzah 5.2 lists clapping, slapping, and dancing among the Shavuot prohibitions. It is not clear, however, whether the problem is making noise in general, or specifically beating to a musical rhythm. A number of early sources, see number 10 in your handout, indicate that the former is the primary issue, making noise. Tosefta Shabbat 17.25 rules, "One who is guarding seeds from a bird or gourds from animals may guard them on the Sabbath as he normally does, as long as he does not clap, slap, or dance or slap as he does on a weekday." Presumably the issue here is making disturbing noises and not being musical. Tosefta Shabbat 2.7 teaches one may raise water with a siphon and allow it to drip from a perforated vessel for a sick person on the Sabbath. Here too, this vessel is making noise, not music. Rabbi Elazar in the Yerushalmi explicitly states, Rabbi Elazar said, "Anything that produces sound is prohibited on the Sabbath." The Yerushalmi continues to cite precedents of various sages who would not knock on a door or on a cup to get someone's attention. Commenting on Isaiah 58:13, "Nor speak a word," Leviticus Rabbah comments, "When the mother of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai used to talk too much on the Sabbath, he would tell her, 'It is the Sabbath,' and she would be quiet." Collectively, these Palestinian sources, I guess he was used to the quiet of the cave. Collectively, these Palestinian sources, a prohibition against making excessive noise on the Sabbath in order to maintain a restful and peaceful environment. In the Bavli, source number 11, however, Ravah states categorically that only musical sound is prohibited. Bavli Eruvin proceeds to question Ravah's stance based on the above mentioned sources from the Tosefta. So let's read this again. Ravah said to him, to Ula, "They only prohibited a musical sound." Abiyah challenged him, "One may raise water with a siphon and allow the water to drip from a perforated vessel for a sick person on the Sabbath. For a sick person it is permitted, but not for a healthy person. What is the case? Is it not that he is sleeping and he wants to wake him up, and making any noise, any sound is prohibited? No, he is awake and he wants him to sleep, and so it is. It sounds like a humming sound, so it is musical." He challenged him, "One who is guarding fruit from birds and his gourds from animals may guard them on the Sabbath as normally does, as long as he does not clap, dance, or slap as he does on weekday. What is the reason? Is it not because he's making a sound, and making any sound is prohibited?" Rav Acha bar Yaakov said, "It is a safeguard, lest he come to pick up a pebble to throw it at the bird. Come and learn. One may draw water from a great cistern using a wheel on the Sabbath. In the temple it is permitted on the Sabbath, but in the country it is not. What is the reason? Is it not because he is making a sound? No, it is a safeguard lest he draw water for his garden or for his ruin." A Mema permitted one to draw water with a wheel in Mechoza. He said, "Why is it prohibited? Lest he come to draw water for his garden or for his ruin. Here there is neither a garden nor a ruin." Once he saw that people were soaking flax in it, he prohibited it. Ravah introduces a significant leniency in the laws of making noise in comparison with his Palestinian predecessors by limiting it only to musical sounds. The Talmud deflects the first challenge to Ravah's ruling from Tosefta Shabbat 2.7 by deeming the soothing white noise created by the perforated vessel to be musical. The Talmud next presents a second objection from Tosefta Shabbat 17:25, but deflects this source too, by explaining that the reason one may not make noise to scare away birds is only because one may then pick up a pebble to throw at the birds, which would violate the biblical prohibition of carrying in a public domain. By explaining the Tosefta not as a prohibition in itself of making noise, but rather as a safeguard to the biblical prohibition of carrying, the Talmud limits the application of the Tosefta to only the case of scaring away animals. The Talmud here does not discuss the related law at Mishnah Betzah 5:2, which categorically prohibits clapping, slapping, and dancing. However, Bavli Betzah 36a, which explains these prohibitions as safeguards lest one come to fix a musical instrument, does also assume Rava's limitation. That's only musical sound. If the reason not to clap and dance is because it will lead to playing and consequently repairing musical instruments, then obviously only clapping and dancing to a rhythm would be prohibited, while other types of noise would be permitted. Ironically then, the Bavli's presentation of the Mishnah as a safeguard to a biblical prohibition, which as we saw above was meant to bolster its authority, at the same time also serves to limit the law's application. It is not explicit at Bavli Betzah 36a that the Talmud's goal introducing the safeguard reason is to limit the law. That just may be a convenient after effect, but it does seem that the Stam there did have Rava's limitation in mind when it linked the prohibition against clapping with the fixing of musical instruments. Back to Bavli Eruvin 104a, the introduction of the safeguard reason here as an answer to the second challenge succeeds in confining the prohibition to cases where one may pick up a pebble, but not any other cases of making noise. We thus see, at least in this case, the Bavli does utilize the strategy of explaining a law as a safeguard in order to limit its application and thus explain it away. This lends support to the possibility that this is part of the reason why the Bavli explains the Shavuot laws at Mishnah Shabbat 5:2 as safeguards. The next challenge from Mishnah Eruvin 10:14 provides yet another example of this phenomenon. The Mishnah names two cisterns as exceptional and that is permitted to draw water from them using a wheel on Shabbat. This implies that drawing water using a wheel from all other cisterns is prohibited. The Mishnah does not provide any reasons for this prohibition. However, Second Temple sources can help fill in the background. Both Jubilees and the Damascus document specifically prohibit drawing water on the Sabbath. The original law is thus an independent prohibition and not a safeguard to something else. The Bavli's initial assumption that drawing water causes a problem of excess noise and commotion that is inappropriate on the Sabbath is likely very close to the Second Temple and Mishnaic conceptions of the law. The Talmud solves the problem by explaining the law as a safeguard, lest one might come to use the drawn water to water one's garden or ruin, and not because of making noise. This explanation of the Mishnah then opens the door tack leniently in cases where the reason does not apply. Amemar here makes exactly this logical deduction. Since in Mechoza there were no gardens or ruins, the safeguard does not apply and drawing water is permitted. Only after people began using the water for other prohibited activities did Amemar reintroduce the prohibition. These examples should suffice to show that the Bavli's explanations of various Shavuot laws as rabbinic safeguards often serve to limit the application of those prohibitions and thus open up areas of leniency. In some cases, this was likely the original reason for providing these reasons. In other cases, the safeguards were originally formulated in order to add legitimacy to Shavuot laws that were no longer considered biblical and would not be taken seriously unless formulated as a preventative measure to biblical violation. But even in these cases, once the reason is only because of a specific safeguard and not a prohibited act in itself, later authorities sometimes took advantage of the loopholes made available in cases where the safeguard does not apply. Let us now focus our attention on 4Q 264a, a small, highly fragmentary manuscript of Sabbath laws, also called 4Q Halacha B, consisting of just a few lines. A smaller fragment, 4Q 421, parallels this text and contains overlapping words, but is even shorter and more fragmentary. It is, however, very useful in filling in some of the lacunas of 4Q 264. The first law in 4Q 264 can be partially reconstructed based on 4Q 421, fragment 13, as well as a Damascus document 1021 and 11:5-6, and refers to the Sabbath limit or tchum. Something like Al Yitalech Ish Chutz Le'iro Kiim Elech Be'ama. But that's not relevant for us today. Most relevant to us today is the next law beginning, let no man take. Al Yikach Ish. This is on page 6 at the top. Joseph Baumgarten published the text of 4Q264A in 1999 and DJD35. Baumgarten makes no attempt to reconstruct line 2 and notes only that CD11.3 includes a law that begins with the same first three words, Al yikach ish alav bigadim so'im, let no man put on himself soiled clothes. As for line 3, Baumgarten notes the parallel at 4Q421, you can see it on the bottom of the page, where the words Migilat Sefer Likra in line 2 of fragment 8 are equivalent to 4Q264, line 4 on the top of the page. Also has the word Taf and Sefer. Right? So therefore the words Lishorer Be, which is on the previous line of 4Q421, that's the second to last line of the page, must be inserted somewhere in the previous line of 4Q264 on top of the page. So he reconstructs the lines, the line as follows. He says, Gam HaKohanim Bnei Aharon Al Yaviu Kleshir Leshorer Bahem Al Kol Ha'alot Bezvachim. Also, the priests of the sons of Aaron shall not bring musical instruments to make song with them over the burnt offerings and the sacrifices. This cannot be a ban on playing instruments on the Sabbath, since according to Baumgarten, blowing trumpets was permissible on the Sabbath. He finds evidence for blowing trumpets on the Sabbath in a K4 fragment of the War Scroll, which mentions Chatzotzot HaShabbatot, the trumpets of Shabbat. Rather, our text contains a ban on carrying musical instruments in public areas, similar to the prohibition against carrying books in 4Q251. There is, however, a problem with Baumgarten's theory. The priests are never responsible for playing musical instruments. They only blow the trumpets, while it's the Levites who play the instruments. This is evident in several verses. See on the next page, sources 19 to 21. ויסדו הבונים את היכל השם והעמידו הכהנים מלובשים בחצוצרות והעלים והלוויים בני הצף במצרתיים להלל את השם על ידי דוד מלך ישראל. And similar with the other verses from Chronicles. Instead, Tikhalar places the words Lishorer Be in line 2 of 4Q264. His reconstruction reads, Al yikach ish lishono ki im lishorer biyom hashabbat. One should not use one's tongue except to sing on the day of the Sabbath. Back to Karl Bachmanyanim. The phrase to take one's tongue is found at Jeremiah 23:31, which you have on the next page. Source number 22. So it's a negative connotation. This law would tie in with the law at lines 7 and 8 in the same fragment. One should not speak a word except to speak words of holiness. In accordance with the law, with the decree, one shall speak to praise God. Indeed, one may speak a word regarding eating and drinking. Because he places the word L'shorer Be in line 2, Tikhalar provides no suggestion as to what was in line 3, but it would presumably be related to the previous line since it begins with the word Gam. Noam and Kimron suggest that this is a prohibition against not only carrying instruments outside, as Baumgarten suggested, but also playing them on the Sabbath, that is, taking them to be played. The next line begins. The next line, beginning with Gam, then applies this law specifically to the priest, who also may not play instruments on the Sabbath, even as part of the sacrificial rites. So let me read their reconstruction. Al yikach ish kol kelei shir leshorer b'hem b'yom haShabbat. Gam haKohanim b'nei Aaron al yikhu kelei shir leshorer b'hem al ha'olot v'hazvachim. So
So actually places the Leshorer both in line 2 and line 3. This reconstruction contains several problems, the first of which Norman and Kimon note themselves. As we said above, for Baumgarten's reconstruction of line 3 is the Levites who are entrusted with playing musical instruments, while the priests only blow trumpets. Norman and Kimon consider the reconstruction, also the priests of the children of Aaron may not take trumpets, chatzotzrot, in order to blow them upon the burnt offering and sacrifices. However, they reject this, first because of that cave 4 fragment of the war scroll, mentioning chatzotzot ha-shabbatot, revealing that they were permitted on the Sabbath. Second, the parallelism with the first law in 4Q264 suggests that this law should also be about musical instruments. They conclude that, quote, in the absence of a complete text, the precise nature of this prohibition remains obscure, end quote. Since Noam and Kimon emphasize the close connection between the laws in line 2 and 3, doubt about the second also undermines the reconstruction of the first. It seems to me that in an effort to find an early echo of the Bavli's laws, Noam and Kimon have actually read into the Qumran fragment a Bavli law that could not possibly have been there. Based on their reconstruction, Noam and Kimon reached several far-reaching conclusions. They show that the rabbis permit playing of all instruments in the Sabbath on the temple. The only source actually for this is the very last one, which says that you can tie a musical string on the Sabbath. So it sounds like you're allowed to play a musical instrument in the temple. So they show that the rabbis permit playing of all instruments in the temple on the Sabbath and polemicize against the sectarian prohibition for which they find evidence in this fragment. Second, other than this fragment, the earliest source for a prohibition against playing musical instruments, as we saw on the Sabbath, is in the Bavli. Noam and Kimon conclude that this fragment, quote, demonstrates that the prohibition against playing musical instruments on the Sabbath was an early one, dating to the Second Temple period, close quote. Strangely, Noam and Kimon do acknowledge that Palestinian sources only record a prohibition against making excessive noise and make no mention of musical instruments. They nevertheless jump to this conclusion in order to connect their reconstructed scroll with the Bavli. They further suggest that this fragment is an early attestation of the Bavli's reasoning that one may not blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah that falls on Shabbat because one may come to carry it in a public domain. Let's review quickly this evidence. Mishnah Rosh Hashanah 4:1 rules that if Rosh Hashanah falls out on the Sabbath, one only blows the shofar in the temple but not anywhere else. Yerushalmi Rosh Hashanah 4:1 provides a biblical source for this. Namely, the Torah includes two verses commanding the blowing of the shofar in Rosh Hashanah. Numbers 29:1 calls it a day of blasting, the shofar, while Leviticus 23:24 calls it a remembrance of blasting, the shofar. The former applies to blowing the shofar in Rosh Hashanah falls out on a weekday, while the latter teaches that one only mentions, but does not actually blow the shofar when Rosh Hashanah falls out on the Sabbath. However, the juxtaposition of the latter verse with what follows it in Leviticus 23:25, which permits one to offer sacrifices on this day in the temple, teaches that the shofar may be blown in the temple even on the Sabbath. Bavli Rosh Hashanah 29b, which you have in front of you, rejects the reasoning presented in the Yerushalmi, since it considers the prohibition to blow shofar to be only rabbinic in the first place, and so no biblical verse would be needed to permit it. Rather, the Ba explains, everyone is obligated to blow the shofar, but not everyone is an expert in blowing shofar. The rabbis thus prohibited blowing on the Sabbath as a safeguard, lest one carries it in his hand and goes to an expert to learn, and he will carry it for a mot in the public domain. This safeguard, however, would not apply in the temple, where rabbinic safeguards were always permitted. So far, these sources follow the trend we have already witnessed. Palestinian sources consider making sounds on the Sabbath to be biblically prohibited, and therefore require a biblical source for the exception on the Sabbath in the temple, while the Bavli does not consider these Shavuot laws to be biblical, and are instead explained as rabbinic safeguards. Noam and Kimron write, open quote, the scholarly consensus holds that Rabbah's decree, which interprets this custom as coming to prevent the transporting of the shofar 4 cubits in the public domain, reflects a late secondary rabbinic Babylonian rationale. Perhaps in light of our fragment, the possibility that Rabbah transmitted echoes of an early Palestinian rationale should be examined. This matter merits further study." End quote. This further study was already conducted decades ago by Chanoch Albeck, who writes that Rabbah actually applied the safeguard originally to the cases in Mishnah Betzah 17b, which you have in front of you, regarding sprinkling someone who was Tameh on Shabbat. And it was Rabbah who transferred his words to Bavli Rosh Hashanah 29b. Bavli Betzah discusses dunking oneself in one's vessels. Sorry, not sprinkling, in Pesachim. Bavli Betzah discusses dunking oneself and one's vessels in a mikveh on Sabbath that precedes Yom Tov. Rabbah prohibits this, lest one come to take the vessels in hand and carry them in the public domain. Abaye there challenges, what if he has a well in his own courtyard? Rabbah responds, there's a safeguard from a well in his own courtyard to a well in public domain. From the fact that Abaye could have asked a similar question in other contexts as well, but does not, it seems that Bavli Betzah is the original application of Rabbah's statement. In that context, it is very likely that a person would want to dunk himself and his clothing at the same time and would undress near the mikveh and carry his clothing for Amot. Rabbah, as it seems from the language at Bavli Rosh Hashanah 29b, you can see that he quotes it as Rabbah says, and then quotes Rabbah, then applies the Gezerah to the case of Shofar. If Albeck is correct, it would render utterly fanciful the already improbable conjecture of Noam and Qimron. I'm out of time, but I hope I've shown how useful the scrolls can be in analyzing rabbinic literature and vice versa, but only when done with proper methodological caution. Thank you. Yes, please. Great question, right? So Book of Jubilees says one may not make war and the penalty of death. So this is probably the earlier law that the Book of Maccabees was responding to, and that's precisely why the Book of Maccabees had to say, well, we can no longer live this way, we have to fight on the Sabbath. I would assume that Jubilees is earlier. Yes?
Perhaps the Kohanim blowing the Chatzos was not necessarily on Shabbat, but before Shabbat, where Shevet Levi played instruments.
Okay, good. Right, so when we say Chatzotrot HaShabbatot, perhaps those are Chatzotrot to announce that Shabbat is coming, like the sirens that we have in Jerusalem and actually in my area in Brooklyn too. So that is a possibility, but the context there does mention sacrifices, so it does seem that it has to do with sacrifices as well. And in addition, in the Torah, actually this week's parasha, where it talks about Chatzot, it says Yom Simchatchem or Moadechem, does not actually mention Shabbat, but Midrash, the Sifra says, Ob Yom Simchatchem, Elu Shabbatot. So it does seem that there is a biblical source for blowing Chatzotzrot on Shabbat along with the sacrifices, and there is no such source for using any other musical instruments. And actually, rabbinic literature does make efforts to show that other musical instruments are also have Pentateuchal source, and perhaps for this very reason, so in order to permit it. Yes, David.
Do you have a sense of why those two moves were being made, or they no longer knew the real reasons, and then this is exegetically where they went? Or do you have a sense of an agenda of some sort? Mm-hmm. Or what do you think?
Right. Good question. I think they're actually both limiting by saying, and not just any noise, but only musical noise. That's limiting it further. Although they ran into a lot of problems because some of the sources that I skipped here from the Christian writers who describe what Jews are doing on Shabbat, Ignatius, Augustine, and John Chrysostom talk about how terrible that the Jews are keeping Sabbath in a corporeal way, and they are clapping and dancing on Shabbat. And so they find this very problematic. So it seems that Jews were doing a lot of clapping on Shabbat, and the Bavli actually recognized that in Bavli Betzah 30a, and therefore says, well, we shouldn't tell them anything, because it's only rabbinic after all, so better that they be shogigin and not mezidin. So the fact that it's only rabbinic allows them to ignore and be lenient about these cases. So Tosafot goes even further and says, well, since it's just a safeguard, because we might come to fix a musical instruments, and nowadays we don't know how to fix musical instruments, therefore we're allowed to clap today. So the law becomes completely, and that makes it into Rama, into Shulchan Aruch. And I guess that's why some people clap and dance on Simchat Torah. I'm sorry, I'm not making a lot of cheer. Yes.
I don't know if this is off the track, but my understanding reading the English translation of Jubilee is that they saw 22 halachos of Shabbat. Am I misreading that or what?
There have been different people that have tried to count it different ways. It could be. Yeah. Why do you think that's
so?
Yeah, yeah. So that some scholars have suggested that, but other scholars think that you can count it in other ways. But yeah, could be. Yeah. I should mention that the other Kimon and Noam do talk about two other laws that they find precedent for. One is burning coals on Shabbat, and they conveniently provide those two words, burning coals, which are not in the original. And something else about reading a Megillat Sefer. Now, it's not clear in the scroll, which you have in front of you, whether this is prohibited or not. So they assume that it is prohibited to read a scroll, and find parallel to that in Mishnah Shabbat. It also talks about scrolls that you can read or not read. Mishnah's reasoning is because of Bitul Bet HaMidrash, something like, don't read too much Tanakh, because then you won't learn Torah Shabbat Peh, which wouldn't make sense for the Dead Sea sect to want to do that. More likely, I think, is the opposite, which is how other people have reconstructed it, that says you should read Torah on Shabbat. And if we read it that way, then actually the entire fragment, as we have it, except for line 1 about the Tchum, is about prohibited and permitted speech. So the first few lines are talking about all the things one should not say, and then the last lines are about things that one is allowed to speak about. So I think that the context and structure of the scroll becomes clearer when you read it that way. Thank you.